Yes, here we are. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. Great to have you with us this week. Aaron Noonan here on the microphone. On the other microphone, Will Dale. Hello, Will.
How you going?
I'm doing super, and we are doing our classic car episode for this episode of the V8 Sleuth Podcast. Great to sit down and go down memory lane with a car that had a very long life with a bunch of different specs and liveries and did all sorts of stuff along the way.
And there's one going out, Mark Gibson, the GIO Commodore. They parked the Nissan this weekend and elected to run with the Commodore.
Well, much of the attention during the week has surrounded rookie driver and former world motorcycle champion Wayne Gardner. The Graham Moore Commodore won't be a threat to the hotshots, but merely having Gardner here at Bathurst is an enormous attraction.
Neil Crompton and the GIO Commodore and Mark Skate share the front row. Off the starting line, Crompton has won it and takes off. Second overall in the championship round, without doubt, his best ever performance in touring cars. He's a friend of ours too. Neil Crompton for the GIO team.
So, Will, the car we are looking at today in our classic car rep is the GIO Commodore. Now, there's been a few GIO Commodores over the years of various specs and models, but the one we're looking at started an era for a major car constructor or chassis constructor in terms of their work with Commodores. We'll touch on that a bit later on. Mm-hmm. It's a car that brought a world champion to Bathurst for the first time in a car. Mm-hmm. It's a car that took a good friend of ours to a breakthrough podium finish in his career. Mm. Cost him a couple of dollars to do it, but we will talk about that in a moment. And it's a car that had a massively long lifespan across Group A, V8 supercars, the Konica series, and some other miscellaneous racing along the way. It is probably the most raced car of the V8 supercar era overall.
I was shocked when we went back and looked at our files on this car that it actually went for that long, because its early history was in a really high, with really high prominent teams, high prominent drivers. And it kept going. Mm. It just kept going. It kept coming back. It had a bit of a rest in the middle, but it kept coming back.
The car you can't kill.
Yeah. And even in the latter days of its career, as we'll get to, it had a few high-profile moments of its own.
Yes, in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. So, the car we are talking about is Denkar 1, the very first Denkar Commodore. When we say Denkar, it is the chassis company that was created originally with Dennis Watson, who was joined by George Smith, who both worked for Brock over the years. Georgie's been with Moffat and Bond over the years as well. They got together in late 1990 for 1991. And they went and did a deal with Wynn Percy for the Holden Racing Team to do fabrication work for Wynn with the new VN Group A Commodores that were coming along. But the first HRT car was actually Denkar 2. Denkar 1 was the GIO Commodore VN Group A that was bought by Bob Forbes and raced by Mark Gibbs, that later became a VP, VR, VS. It had a whole bunch of different lives that we'll talk about on the pod. But it was at a time when Commodore had not been the car to win in Group A. It was the car of choice for privateers because of its cost and its availability up against the turbo cars that were expensive and high tech. And Bob Forbes' team was one of those. I mean, that had a few VL Commodores over the journey. This VN, though, was their first, it was the first VN. In fact, before the VN debuted as a touring car in 1991, I think this car was on display at the Sydney Motor Show at the end of 1990. Obviously not fully finished and complete, but pretty damn well close too. And it's that red GIO livery that was on the Nissan, of course, later the next year, stood out. It looked fantastic, clean, very simple, clear cut, minimal other sponsors and signage. If you say the GIO cars today, race fans know what you mean.
It's funny because you associate red with being very much a Holden colour, but there weren't very many red Commodores on the grid that
Not
back
even
then.
The factory cars were red. They were black and white.
Absolutely. And it's funny to think that it was essentially a privateer team that was a very early adopter for the brand new Commodore. But, of course, the VN had been in gestation for an extended period of time. The VL TWR Walkinshaw, the Group A fuel-injected car, was not meant to race as long as it did. The VN was meant to be introduced in early to mid-1990, then there were homologation delays.
Well, the VN had been a road car since 88.
Exactly, yeah.
So, it took a while to get to the racetrack in terms of touring car competition. And over the journey, there weren't many VN Commodores built. There were barely any. If you could count them on nearly, well, let's do it, on two hands. There's this car that we're focusing on our classic car episode today, the GIO car, yep. HRT built a total of 3 VNs in that 91 season. They all went on to be VPs and other things later on.
So that's 4.
Larry Perkins' team built 5
yep.
VNs.
That brings us to a total of 9. What are the
2? Terry Finnegan built a car.
10.
The Foodtown Blue car. That's 10. Oh, I'm running out.
Yeah, I'm hard-pressed to think of too many more.
I can't think of any more. Not off the top of my head anyway.
Because, of course, the Bob Forbes product car was a Perkins-built car, as was yep. Alf Barbagallo's Castrol yep. car.
Of course, there were the mobile cars. There was the Tommy Sahado car, which, by the way, are in the new Perkins Engineering Car History book. We are going through sending out pre-orders this week. Book stock has arrived. If you've already pre-ordered, it'll be on its way soon. So check your email for tracking numbers and the like. We have sold out nearly all of this book. We don't have many left, a couple of hundred of 2,500 left, which is a phenomenal a take-up rate from the pre-order period. So if you haven't ordered yet, I've got to tell you now, get in or you'll miss out. Bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Yeah, not many VNs. This was one of them. And, of course, they didn't start the season with this car, the Bob Forbes team. Mark Gibbs, of course, was their driver. He'd been driving for Bob for a couple of years in the VL Commodores before this. But they started with the VL. They didn't have a VN racing in that first round at Sandown in 91. The two mobile cars were there for Brock and Perkins. The Wynn Percy HRT car was there, but it took a little bit longer for this car to make its debut. In fact, it didn't start in a touring car round. It debuted in an Amps car round at Amaru with Gibbs at the wheel. Of course, Forbes' team was a Sydney-based team, so it made sense that they would run the Amps car series, and they did quite a bit around that time. So April 1991 is when this car kicked off. So it's just over 30 years ago. Here we are still talking about it. And it's actually... it's dubbed in our records as RF04. You might be thinking, RF, it's not what the race team was called. Robert Forbes.
Yes, Bob makes Forbes. Total sense yeah, when, makes you, total when sense. You think about
and
it.
And they had 3 VL Group A SV Walkinshaw models prior to that. So this was the 4th Commodore. Of course, that he and his team over the years had all sorts of different cars. But in terms of the Holden Group A Commodores, this was the 4th one, hence why it was what it was. But the funny thing is they finally wheel out this new car. They take it to the track. They go racing with it. And then they pretty much bench it straight away because they go and buy a Nissan GTR.
Well, that's the thing. In 1991, it became very obvious very quickly that if you wanted to run near the front of the field or even hopefully win stuff, the Nissan GTR was the car to have. So, yeah, Bob Forbes went and did a deal with Fred Gibson and bought the only customer Nissan GTR built by the team.
Yeah, one of 5. There were 5 built overall. That was the only customer car. And it debuted in the GIO team's hands later the year. I think it was Oran Park at the touring car round, the final round of the Shell Australian Touring Car Championship in that season.
Mm.
So, it's a very strange scenario where you have this car that you've developed and that you've built and that you've raced.
It's basically new.
It's still pretty fresh, yeah. And then you basically park it because, of course, the Nissan at, well, I'm guessing, about $500,000 back in those days, which big money and particularly now. Yeah. Yeah, and the rest. And, of course, that car was run and serviced by Gibson's in between rounds. It was crewed by the Forbes team on the race weekends, but it was very much a Gibson prep car. And this Commodore that we're talking about has – the Gibson tie-up come in a little bit later on. The Gibson-Forbes relationship was very close for a while. Obviously, it's no longer. It all turned to muck through the whole Craig Lowndes and 00 Motorsport and court case and everything that went on there. But isn't it strange that you've gone and got this car, got it up and running, but you just park it virtually straight away. But when you see what replaced it, it kind of makes sense as to why and how. However, that car, a lot of people forget, went to Bathurst as the backup for the Nissan GIO GTR in 91, although it didn't make it to the grid.
No, it did appear on track, and it was actually entered as the second product under a second product entry for...
Still with the GIO-based colours, but with product stickers.
Yeah, some bright flashes of yellow, of fluoro yellow for, was it Bruce Stewart or Darren Stewart?
Darren Stewart, and Bruce's son, and Bob Tindall. Yeah, but it failed on the warm-up lap. So, and in those days, cross-entering was permitted whereby you could nominate your drivers in the one team across multiple cars, which
which is how Mark Scaife set the fastest lap of the race in the number two Nissan GT-R, not the number one car that he won in.
Exactly. So he holds a place in Bathurst history that will never be beaten to win the race in one car and set the fastest lap of the race in the other car. But yeah. then this scenario set off a situation that never was seen before or since, and it didn't happen in the day on the day because the drivers didn't need to jump ship. Whenever cross-entering occurred with teams previously, it was within the team who ran the same sorts of cars. Of course, Peter Brock famously jumped cars twice, won Bathurst twice.
Yep.
Boy, that still cops hate on socials. It's unbelievable
how – very strongly about it.
Yeah, it winds people up. But the reality is he wasn't the only one to do it. Lots of other people did it.
He wasn't even the first one to do it. They Alan Moffat
They just didn't win the race.
One of the first.
Yeah, he didn't in 1980.
Yeah.
Now, he jumped Ford to Ford, his car to the Bob Morris Bill O'Brien car. Yeah. Over the years, the ANZ Sierra drivers swapped between the Peter Jackson Sierra drivers, the factory Toyota Corollas, Dick Johnson. They were all the same type of car. So this would have been the only time that had Gibson Onslow's Nissan crapped itself.
Which it did late in the race.
Which
but
it was
made
struggling
it to the
and coughing and spluttering its way around to finish third. Had they jumped, they would have jumped into a completely different type of car, brand, model, make, everything.
So strange. So strange. And yet there are people who miss cross-entering.
Yeah, I don't think there's that many.
No, it's a very small minority, very vocal.
It's a small enthusiast base, yeah. I reckon. Of course, the Nissan won the Sandown 500 and they finished third, the GIO car. So this car, the Commodore, was parked up. And, of course, there was a big brouhaha about in 92 about what the weights of the Nissans and the restrictions that had been put on the car.
Well, of course, because on race day at Bathurst in 91, Holden, Ford, Channel 7 and Shell had basically put a gun to Cams's head and said, look, you're changing the rules for touring car racing or we're all leaving. So very soon after that, the rules were going to be introduced for 1993, Holden versus Ford V8 powered sedans. So 1992 became kind of an interim year where they tried to play with all the weights and play with rev limits across all the cars to try and achieve some level of parity, which each team, in particular the Nissan team, tried
fudged
to
the shit out
yes.
of.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to see how you were going to say it, but I figured you weren't going to say it like
no,
that.
No, I wasn't. So, you put it very accurately.
Well, meanwhile, while all this is going on in 1992, so, of course, the factory cars are now Winfield. The GIO cars continue to be raced by Mark Gibbs.
On Dunlops as opposed to the Yokohamas of the factory
that was the major,
cars.
Yeah, that was the major difference between them, wasn't it? That was definitely the major difference. But this Commodore's still here. It's still hanging around. It's still there just in mothballs, ready and waiting if required. It's kind of like the netball, here if you need, pass to me. And that car underwent a huge re-engineering project in 1992. Maurice Rissman, who had worked on so many race cars over the years, I think there's photos still. If you go to the Raider Motorsport website, I think there's some photos online of the work that went on that car in 92. Massive re-engineering project. At that point, the red interior, of course, the GIO red, was changed to silver. And remember, this car raced as a silver Commodore in the hands of Rowan Onslow in the Amps car series.
The Chicago Pneumatics livery, yeah.
Correct, which a lot of people would completely forget because by that stage, the Amps car series was waning a little bit. The fields had shrunk to, 9, 10, 11 cars. Good quality, though. And Amps, we should do an Amps car pod at another stage.
Agreed.
It was the touring car series within the series kind of thing. In 92, the Nissan GDRs were constantly there, the two factory cars and the GIO car. Tony Longhurst regularly took a fleet to BMWs. Paul Morris was on the scene by that stage. Bondi was a local with his Caltex Sierra, and you threw in like Bob Pearson, the Lansvale boys, Terry Finnegan.
And a bunch of Corollas.
A few Corollas here and there, and maybe the odd 635 BMW that was still lurking. Thank you to the Golsons.
Yes.
10, 12 cars, 92's Amps car series was still pretty good for in terms of racing, but it was depending on
And they
on
were
what,
smart enough to put on a race as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And depending on what market you were in, it was when you – what time you saw it. Obviously, in Victoria, we would see those at 10:30 at night.
Whereas in Queensland, we'd see them just before the 6 o'clock news.
Damn you, Will. Damn you. And Sydney Siders would have been the same to see it locally. So, And like the AmpsCar series only went one more year after that. But this car lives on in the rebirth of AmpsCar later on down the track. So come 1992, there's this big brouhaha over the weight that's been put in the Nissans. Fred Gibson threatens court action. There's umming and ahhing about what's going to happen. In the end, the Nissans all ran.
Yeah, basically saying it was unsafe for them to run at such a high weight.
Correct. And this Commodore is still lurking. It's still here. It's still hanging around. And we end up seeing, as all of this is playing out during the course of 1992, Wayne Gardner retires from motorcycle racing. 92 was his last season in the World Championship with the Rothmans Honda team. And he started to do a little bit of touring car stuff overseas.
He raced a Jägermeister M3 as a teammate to his good mate Armin Hahn in the DTM.
Exactly. So Gardner is out of bikes, getting into cars. Bathurst is coming.
Mm.
And I tell you what, the deal man of all deal mans, Graham Moore, who put together the Williams Renault thing a few years later with Super Touring and all sorts of sponsorships over the years, gets Wayne Gardner into this car for Bathurst with Strathfield Car Radio's backing, who he'd been involved with previously when he ran with Tony Noske about 4 years earlier.
Mm.
And Wayne Gardner comes to Bathurst and drives this very car. So the car that didn't start the race in 91 as the kind of backup car.
Now had the most famous driver now, in the field in
now it. Now has the most 92. Famous Bathurst 1000 rookie in the field in 1992 on board. So fair to say it's gone from the shithouse to the penthouse in terms of exposure levels between what it got in 91 and what it got in 92.
Now, Strathfield Car Radio has definitely got value for money that year, I feel. To be fair, it was a smart move by Gardner because there were reports that he and Armin Hahn were potentially going to be in a second Perkins Engineering car. Which had an entry. But in the end, pairing with Graham Moore, it was a combination that, with all due respect, wasn't an outright contender to win. So it lowered expectations on Wayne as to what he was going to do. It was a good way to experience. In theory, it was a good way to learn and experience Mount Panorama in a touring car until the weather turned on Sunday.
I was about to say. And then he looked at the weather radar.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was messy. It was not nice that day at all. Of course, the 92 race is famous for Jim Richards' crowd assessment at the end of the day. I think that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to clean things up after dropping a bit of a terrible line earlier on, so I'm just trying to make it sound nice from here on in. But he called them a pack of arseholes. If you haven't seen The Vision, you should probably go back and check it out. I'm not sure what rock it's been under, but it must have been a big rock, that's for sure. But and it was definitely the right way to go. To make your debut, there's no expectation when you're driving a privateer car, because if you go well, that's a bonus. People look at you and go, oh, how good have you gone?
Mm.
And if you don't go that well, you go, well, he wasn't going to go very good anyway. He's still learning. It's an old car. It's not a full-time team, rah, rah, rah.
Yeah.
And it worked out in a good situation. Of course, he ends up full-time with the Holden Racing team the next year, which I think a lot of people even at that stage couldn't have imagined as being possible. Graham Moore ran that car at the Adelaide Grand Prix to round off the year. Of course, that was the farewell to Group A in Australia. Mm. That was the last Group A as we knew it. Of course, the 92 Group A was Australianized Group A, I guess you would say, with those.
Well, the VN wasn't actually eligible for international Group A because 500 of them were never built.
302, I think, was the number or thereabouts, and it was kind of a near enough, good enough, go on you go on your way, scallywag, just get it out.
So it was
there.
All right in Australia and, I guess, New Zealand, but yeah. Internationally, it was not a thing.
No, but I tell you what was a thing for 93, 5-litre racing. The new V8 touring car rulebook that you mentioned earlier came into being. And, of course, for the factory Nissan team, it meant they couldn't be factory Nissans anymore. No. They had to pick a side. And a lot of people thought Fred Gibson would go with Ford, given he had been a factory driver with Alan Moffat and Bo Seaton.
Won
Bathurst with the Fox, Harry Firth in 67. But went Holden. Did a deal with Holden, and obviously they were building up a couple of cars that were very much kit cars for 93. So when you're building new cars, but you don't have a car yet built to go testing with over summer, what do? You use this car. You borrow this one from your mates at Forbes's. So Scaife, particularly Scaife, he used to do all the testing back in those days for Gibson's.
Yeah, Jimmy wasn't a big fan of testing, was he?
Not in the Gardner era, the Gibson era. It was kind of, he got in and drove them when it mattered on race weekends. So Mark Scaife took over this car on various days and drove it as something of a test mule for the Winfield team's cars. But don't forget, it still had the Holden V8 engine, not the Chevy engine at this point. Mm. But so then, so there again, the Gibson and Forbes link stays. So although Forbes had brought on the Nissan in 91, this Commodore just kind of kept lurking around. So, but it was a smart idea to have it around because the rules changed. Didn't have to go and build a brand new car, yeah, which they did do later in 93.
Mm.
But here was this car virtually ready to go.
And there wasn't really anything else you were going to do with a VN Group A in that era, or in 91, 92 anyway, because the what's the word I'm looking for here? The recession we had to have kind of sapped the field of privateer entries. So, you really, there wasn't really anyone you were going to sell that car to, so you might as well hang on to it. And yeah, then when it became obvious what was going to happen for 1993, well, a shell's a shell. It's already built up as a race car, and the VN to VP conversion, as we know,
not a big step.
Not a big step.
No, not a big step. And at this point for 1993, Mark Gibbs was out of the driver's seat. I think he had business commitments. I think he had more stuff going on as well. But anyway, the flow out of it all was that Neil Crompton picked up the drive in the GIO Bob Forbes car. So, a guy who had, funnily enough, driven for Fred Gibson at Bathurst the previous year in the number two Winfield car, found his way back into a full-time touring car ride. Having, he'd been with Brock the previous year, but that all fell apart with Advantage Racing after four rounds and they ran out of cashola. And Crompo found himself back in a car in the GIO team. And, of course, that year it developed quite nicely because Wally Storey came on board. He left the Holden Racing team and headed there. They had a really good team. So, they were in Monavale up in Sydney, and apologies to the Sydney siders who I massacre the names of your suburbs, but I challenge any Sydneyite to say Paran when they read it.
fair.
They had a good little team. Good little team of people. Peter Harker was there, who was with the Holden Motorsport for a very long time and had been with HRT prior to that. So they had a good little crew of guys. So for Crompo, this was a great opportunity to jump in and get his way back behind the wheel and get in and among it at a time when the V8 touring car formula was starting to put a bit of fuel in the fire underneath it all, and we got good crowds and Channel 7 were obviously massively behind it. But as Crompo describes in his new book, which, by the way, is available now, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au, there's two really great stories he tells in this book, and they both come from racing this car in 1993. I won't go into the specifics because you should really read the book. It's a cracker.
They are good.
Yeah. But Wayne Gardner got him at Amaru, absolutely drilled him one, and he saved it up, and he saved it up, and he saved it up, and he got him back later in the year at Barbagallo in the rain.
What do they say? Revenge is a dish best served cold?
It was very cold that day. It was very wet that day. But he got him. He absolutely got him. And I think at the time, he got fined, Crompton, $1,000. And while doing the book with him, he says, the best $1,000 I ever spent. And then there's a really funny side to all of this of how he then picked up the drive with Wayne Gardner the next year, who bought the team he'd been driving for, the Bob Forbes team. That's a whole other story. You got to buy the book. It's a, look, I know I'm biased because I worked with Neil on it, but there's a bunch of stories in there, including these ones I think you'll enjoy. And the other incident in the GIO Commodore in 93 that's in the book, and it's a corker, is when he and Larry Perkins had a major misunderstanding, I think that's one way to put it, at Winton that year, where basically they had been belting, Larry had been Morse coding the back at Neil. Neil fried a short circuit and it blew, and it short circuited bad. And in the end, they had both ended up off in the boonies and dealt with themselves at the steward's office before they even got there. So that's a pretty good story in the book. But you've got one too that you enjoy from that year, from that car, that a lot of people probably forget as well. We talked about Amp's car before because it's a bit off the radar from people, but there's one that you still snigger every time we mention this one.
So the 93 Amp's car series, which was the last Amp's car series in the original run, the lead car entries for it came from the Gibson team, the Bob Forbes team, so Crompton in this car, and the BMW M3s of Tony Longhurst and Paul Morris. Now, of course, armed with the new high downforce VP Commodore, Crompton was very fast in this car. Was it pole position or on, he was definitely on the front row for the race that I'm thinking of. Might have been pole.
But I think it might have been pole.
Yeah. Unfortunately, his front row advantage didn't quite translate to the opening race, where he was accused, or at least found, to have jumped the start. And he was not very happy about it, as he explained on race cam during the race to the to Mike Raymond and the commentary team.
And Crompton peels off into the pits.
Yes, I tell you what, I think it's a stop-and-go penalty for an infringement at the start.
Well, I tell you what, we have got the world's...
Let's go down to Andy.
Yes, you're exactly right, Mike. Neil Crompton really deemed to crept on the start. As you just saw, he was not too happy about the stop-go penalties back out on the track.
Neil Crompton coming back through the field after a stop-and-go penalty. Neil, I would think, and all of us agree, that was a pretty harsh decision.
That was absolutely disgraceful, Mike. I don't know what I'm even doing out here. We should just pack the whole show up and go home.
Well, I don't blame you, Neil. I think it was a savage attack, and unfortunately, as you know, you can't appeal it. The judge of fact on the start line, he can do what he wants, and if we don't smarten this standard up pretty soon, there's going to be a lot of people revolting.
Well, that's right. Well, they're revolting people, so... What can I say? I mean, I'm trying not to blow my cool here and say things I shouldn't say, trying to get on with the job. But I know when I jump a start, Alan, I'm sure you know the feeling.
Exactly.
The light turned green, I started the motor car. The fact that the rest of them were asleep is not my problem.
So a little fired up there, Uncle Neil, just quietly, just a little bit.
Very close to blowing another fuse.
How big was his fuse box? How many fuses were there to blow there?
Not happy. No,
not happy.
No.
But you know what? I watched the tape again. He definitely moved. He rolled. He definitely rolled.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm sure
the fact was not wrong in this instance, unfortunately.
No, I'm sure we'll get a reply from him on that one. But
That's all right. He doesn't listen to podcasts. Remember.
That's right. He did tell us fine. That. Yeah, we're good. You know what? He's not on socials. He's just not really interested. He's a busy man. I think we can say what we like and we should get away with it. It should be fine. It should be fine. So when Neil wasn't having a run-in with Wayne Gardner, Larry Perkins, the starter at Amaru, otherwise interesting year at 93. But the thing was too, that car was clearly overweight by that stage. It still had the Holden V8 engine, whereby everyone else bar Larry Perkins had gone to the Chev. Even Winfield with their new cars had rolled out with Chevs. Peter Brock was with Chev with Advantage Racing. The HRT cars obviously had the new Chev. Privateers stuck with the Holden in pretty much all occasions. And the GIO team did as well. But they put together another car that debuted at Oran Park in the touring car round with a Chev engine. And that was a really nice car at the time. It's the car that Neil led the Sandown 500 in September that year. But the Holden-powered car that we're talking about did run at Oran Park. Mark Gibbs came back and drove it as car number four, as a bit of a get your eye in before coming and doing the Enduros as Neil's co-driver.
Mm.
But then it was sold. It was actually sold to Stuart McColl, the privateer who had been running an ex-Bob Forbes VL. So he went to Bathurst with Peter Gazzard in 93 and it stayed in the GIO livery, albeit it wasn't it wasn't the primary car. It was the Crompton Gibbs car was definitely the primary. He ran the Adelaide Grand Prix in it. And then the next year brought back some familiar Kalari colours. Remember that it ran in the Kalari Transport colours in 94?
Yeah, it was a good-looking livery. The
orange
and yellow.
Orange and yellow. Yeah, that stood out. Again, drove it in quite a few touring car rounds that year. Gazzard co-drove at Bathurst. And then this car went on this weird little period of not getting to
a
racetrack.
Well, a couple of years.
Yeah, a gap year period is probably the best way to describe it. So Peter McLeod bought this car as well as the Brad Jones Craig Lowndes 94 HRT Bathurst runner-up car, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Took the mechanicals from this Perk X GIO car and put them into the HRT shell. No.
Mm.
Didn't work. Totally didn't work.
Yeah.
Just it's kind of like round peg square hole type stuff. Just the Harrop gear went out the door, sort of some PE gear and some GIO gear and some whatever.
It wasn't an era where I guess even now things aren't necessarily directly interchangeable between different manufacturers of the same car, but it's a lot closer and easier than it was back then.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot more freedom in what you could do and how you could build things.
Yeah, and in Peter's words when I spoke to him about this some time, it was a total disaster. It just the HRT car never worked with those bits in it, and it didn't work. But what happened to this car that we're talking about, the XGIO VNVP, so by this stage it's still a VP, John Henderson, remember the policeman who raced some years later in Super Touring? He ran a Vectra. He was looking to get into the V8 touring car side of things. Of course, this is before – it wasn't called V8 supercars at this point in 1995.
Still Group A touring cars.
5 litres, V8s, Group A, whatever you want to call it. It had a few different names. So from what I remember in 1995, they put a new floor in this thing. They changed the roll cage, went to a bare shell rebuild on this car.
But remained a VP.
Stayed in VP gear, even though VR was new for 1995 body kit-wise. And I think they were going to run a Chev in it from that point. But it never made it to a track to race in 1995 or 1996. And then Richard Mork got his hands on it for 1997.
Yes, the Morkmobile.
And I reckon there's two things that stand out to me from 1997. I'm pretty sure at that period it had a four-speed gearbox.
Excellent.
And which That's would make unusual. It the only V8 supercar with a four-speed. And when he ran the Shell Australian Touring Car around at Eastern Creek in 97, the signage on his car had the ARDC AMSCAR series on the car, the rival series that was being run for privateers. So as we talked about before, this car's got some nice AMSCAR links. So at the end of 93, the 94 AMSCAR series was canned.
Yeah, it was meant to be. It was meant to end up being just one round at Amaroo,
which Stephen Johnson was apparently going to run in the Fuddruckers for, but that all fell apart.
Yes.
So the AMSCAR series went on the shelf for a few years, but the ARDC brought it back in 97 with a Goodyear control tyre aimed at privateer touring car teams. Of course, the V8 supercar era had begun. Tony Cochran and IMG were involved. The ARDC were the traditional custodians of the Bathurst 1000. There was plenty of politics. This is for the AMSCAR pod another time down the track. But basically, there was a scenario whereby the first round of the AMSCAR series in 97 was canned at Amaroo because there was a big brouhaha over the rev limiters being used and that they weren't approved rev limiters or that they weren't the ones they should be having. So they turned it into a ride day rather than an actual race event. I think actually Robbie Farr was going for a ride with Jeff Kendrick in a HRT car or ex-HRT car and they rolled it going up the hill. Jeez. That's a whole other story for another day. So anyway, fast forward later in the year, Richard Mork, plain white, number 77 Commodore with the ARDC AMSCAR series on the side of it. That's kind of like, I'm trying to think of a comparative scenario, but it's kind of like you may as well have just put Toka Super Touring on the side of the thing at the time. It's a bit like sponsoring a supercar with a TCR banner for an upcoming event or something. It's a bit along those lines.
Cheeky bit of guerrilla advertising.
But didn't have to peel the stickers off. It's not like the year. Remember that there was a year at Bathurst maybe 5-6 years ago when it was still on channel must have been Channel 7 era, so it would at least be 2014 or 13 or somewhere around there. Grant Denyer raced an Aussie race car with Family Feud sponsorship.
Oh, yeah, I do remember this.
And that caused a bit of a brouhaha over, what could be shown and what wouldn't be shown and how it would be shown.
Not like the good old days of
Channel 9, Kevin Camaro. Kevin Butler Camaro. The Kevin Camaro, I call
exactly.
So Richard, they're the things that stick out for me with Morky, and he ratted in that AMSCAR series and popped up at the Eastern Creek Touring Car Round and then appeared the following year in a purple and yellow livery, never before seen or never since.
Distinctive. Stood out. You didn't miss it.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. It definitely-
I didn't mind the liveries that this car ran in Morky's era. They're always bright, colourful, something very different.
That's one way to put it. Yeah, they definitely stood out. But then remember that year Sandown 500 was really wet. It started dry and it got wet later on. And it was quite bad.
Yeah.
And that car got absolutely pulverized at the end of the main straight in an incident. I can't even remember who hit the back of it. Maybe it was the Greg Creek Ericsson car. Someone drilled it because of the visibility being so poor. It got absolutely smashed. He was sharing it with Bill Cedars, the super truck driver who did a fair bit of touring car racing around that time in V8s. So for Bathurst to fix the car, they thought, well, while we're at it, we'll update it. So it went from VP, finally got to VR, 3 years after the VR model was permitted in the category.
And after the VR model had been superseded by the VS.
Yeah, it's only a small little
And the VT
tweak.
Was already on the grid.
It was. It was. And I think if memory serves correct, the weather that day and the accidents that went on that day, including this one, from there, the rain lights were introduced on V8 supercars, which obviously were much easier to see rather than just the regular brake lights on those cars. So this car did help, I guess, develop some element of safety in V8 supercar racing. But really, when you strip it all down and you go back through all the things that we've talked about with this car, its starring role, its banner-head achievement is being one of the stars of the In the Pits documentary that aired on ABC, surely.
How good was that documentary? We still see people talking about it now, commenting on our Facebook page and socials. Yeah. We love it as well. Like it's
a different era. It's amazing to see how much has changed in that, 22 years or whatever it's been.
And so entirely unfiltered. The fact that you could have a camera sitting with Larry Perkins outside a steward's hearing, or as he's creeping up to the door to try and listen in to hear what they're saying, or having a camera with Larry as he's having a very robust discussion with Chief Scrutiny John Shepherd, or Category Technical Officer, I should say, John Shepherd.
That's right, it was too, yeah. And then you had Chris Smurden.
Yes, Captain Dick Around.
That's right, which is mentioned in our Perkins Engineering car book, by the way. And, of course, they followed Richard Mork for a time. And the level of battler getting that car on the track was evident in that doco, for sure, which followed. If you're not across it, it was 1999, I think it was, the year. It was a documentary that was made following and Melinda Price was featured in it as well.
Yep.
V8 supercar racing of the era, following Perkins, Smurden, Melinda.
Following a cross-section of different teams.
Pro, female racer, businessman racer in Smurden and battler,
absolute privateer.
Absolute privateer, Morky. So, I think it's about a 90-minute duration. It's probably available still on a DVD via eBay somewhere or here, there or somewhere. Probably should be something that we could convince the ABC to air on iView or something somewhere, sometime. It's very stark, but the standout line in that documentary is Larry Perkins.
Oh, which one?
No, there's one.
There's one that gets remembered and also gets butchered.
It is, as we found out,
whilst researching the book.
Yes. So the Nathan Pretty Commodore hitting the top of the mountain wall, the yellow privateer car.
Yeah.
When Larry's sitting there, and I think he might be with Jack or he's with Oscar Fiorinotto, and he looks across and he goes, "Young bloke, cold tyres, effed up." But that's how I always remember it.
That's how I always remember it too.
But it's not quite right.
No, when we went back and looked at the book, and I'm going to have to-
Should we just play the audio for the listeners?
Yeah, let's just play it.
This is what he said on the doco as he watched the car hit the wall.
Young bloke, cold tyres, fucked up.
Close.
Yeah, it's like how everyone misremembers Crocodile Dundee's immortal line.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not a knife.
What is the line again? That's not a knife. This is a knife.
That's what everyone thinks.
Yeah.
But the line is, now that's a knife.
Yeah.
As he pulls his out.
Isn't it funny how history slightly tweaks things?
Yeah.
We all just remember it how we like to remember it best or remember it easiest. Anyway. So the In the Pits doco is where this car starred really over time. And then this livery, it sort of morphed. It morphed a little bit, I guess you would say. So that it became a multicolored car running under the V8 Racing banner. It ran Bathurst in 98, 99. I think Christian DeGosten was the co-driver of the year that the doco was being filmed.
99 retired with, I think, a broken rocker, if I remember, from the doco. 98 retired.
Oh, tell me about 98. This was great.
So I don't remember exactly what happened to the Mork car on track. I think it broke down. Yeah, but it got towed to Parc Fermé.
Which was meant it's out of the race.
Yes. Except the car, there was nothing wrong with the car. It shouldn't. And according.
This is a bit like Tim Slade at Adelaide 500 a few years ago, where they put him on the truck and he was saying, no, I'm fine. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. I just want to get going again.
Except Sladey didn't proceed to do a burnout in part when the car got back to Parc Fermé, like Richard Mork did, to illustrate the fact that the car was perfectly fine and capable of running.
that's one way to prove it.
So, he, of course, couldn't rejoin the race. It was prevented from rejoining the race because the car was in Parc Fermé. Can't emerge.
Point of no return.
Point of no return.
Yep.
However, he did lodge a formal protest against that. And in the end, the event organisers, who were IMG at the time, were fined $10,000 by CAMS for incorrectly transporting the car to Parc Fermé when the car was in a drivable condition. The front spring had collapsed. That was what the issue. The car was drivable and could have made it back under its own power or was easily repairable.
So, let me recap this car's Bathurst history. Warm-up lap non-starter, 91. Yes. Low. 92, world champion motorcycle hero arrives. High. 93, privateer run has a bit of a delayed run off the radar. Low.
Got a lot of airtime by coming into the pits.
It did. Yeah. Stuart McCullough had a pretty good run. I think they finished in 94. He and Gazzard, 10th to 15th, somewhere in that,
had a reasonable run, yeah,
that period. Then it doesn't run at all at Bathurst for a few years.
Low.
Very low.
Yes.
Flatlined. 98, returns, but returns. It's got a bit of everything, this car. That's why we picked it, because it's got so many things to talk about.
In our database, in the AN1 data database, this car is unique specifically for this race as having Bathurst 1990, FIA 1000 Classic 1998, car 77, did not finish, reason, other, brackets, organizer error. we've got a few interesting ones in the database.
I think that's the only years,
but
one
that's a good,
got that's, that one.
Yeah, that one's unique.
That is very, very unique. Now, speaking of unique, there is the Doco of 99. Then we go to Bathurst in 2000. So, in 2000, the Konica V8 Light Series began, the second tier category for supercars. So, Craig Bastian, who'd been a Formula Holden driver, leased this car for a round before he ended up getting a car of his own. And Mork raced at Bathurst with Steve Williams. And Steve Williams had driven with Terry Finnegan in the 80s, so he'd been around a very long time.
It was like in the Laser series when Mark Scaife was coming through.
Yeah, true. Very true. But Bathurst 2000, that was my first Bathurst as a full-time journalist, Motorsport News magazine. Rained for like a week before and during. Still
drying. You
didn't
have much luck with Bathursts in that early era because you were at the 99 Super Touring one, as
we
recently discussed.
Yeah, that was not long before that, and still was drying out from that one to go to the next one in 2000. 01 was a little bit better, though.
It still rained.
It did, but not as bad as 2000. But in 2000, remember, this was the year that Russell Ingall fired a broadside during a press conference, being upset with the level of. Of course, it was still a 55 car grid. Back then, it was all the main championship drivers, and then a bunch of cars from the Konica series were, in essence, what we'd call wild cards now, but they were added to the field to make a capacity field. And Russell described some of these other privateers and slow drivers as being from, quote, Planet Mork.
Yes.
Which got lots of attention, and he ended up getting fined out of all that, didn't he?
Got fined a sizable amount. I can't remember what the exact number was, but it was in the. It was, I think the original fine was something like $10,000 for bringing
it's
the
in
sport
the database
to disrepute.
I'm sure of it.
Oh, surely. I think
Bathurst
Russell's
2000
full.
Reason for fine, other.
here it is. Okay. So, in the end, Ingall received a $4,000 fine and was ordered to pay CAM's legal costs of $2,130 for comments that were deemed prejudicial to motorsport. But,
right.
But originally, the fine had been levied to Perkins Engineering, which was a $10,000 fine for bringing the sport into disrepute.
For the Planet Mork comment?
For the Planet Mork comment.
Hmm,
and it was subsequently appealed, and the fine on Perkins Engineering was rescinded, but the one that that
so
led
Larry
to the
got a fine transferred to Russell. Is that what you're trying to say?
Because at that point, there was no mechanism to actually fine a driver specifically for bringing the sport into disrepute. You could only fine the team.
All right. Well, so they changed that in the years to come after
sure
that, didn't
did.
They? Because it was a regular thing in that 2000 era of V8 supercars of bringing the sport into disrepute. It was a constant thing, particularly in the mid-2000s, where it was just over-dramatized, overused.
A good,
and over
a good revenue racer.
Yeah, it was over everything.
And before
everything.
And before anyone asks, we did look for the audio of Ingall's comments, but have not been able to find it.
One day. It'll one be day. Around somewhere. We'll find a way to weave it into a pod somewhere. Now, speaking of the history of this car that started its life as the GIO VN, it kept going. You'd think by this time on the pod, this is the bit where we wrap it up and we say it's all done and dusted. But no. It carries on. It carries on. 2001, it carries on. Steve Williams actually tried to qualify it for the Oran Park Shell Round in 01, didn't actually pre-qualify. Because there's a couple of cars trying to make it into the field that weekend. One of them was Matt Neal in that second Paul Morris Motorsport car that he pancaked at the final corner.
Which is why he didn't make it into the field.
Funnily enough, yeah. That was a slight barrier to getting into the race, the fact that the car had been bananaed.
Yes.
Richard Mork ran this car continually in the Konica series over the next couple of years. And then in 2004 in something called the V8 Touring Car Challenge, which a lot of our listeners might not remember, but it was basically a series that brought together XV. This is before the Kumo V8 Touring Car Series was created.
Hey, so there was no third tier.
Third tier. Brought together old V8 supercars. It brought together super tourers, future tourers, Group A cars, other oddities that kind of fit the blend. And that so this car ran in that for a time with Mork at the helm. And then John Burke, a guy, raced it in that Touring Car Challenge Series as well in 2005. And so here we are 14 years on from this car first racing as a VN in 1991, and it was still going at this point, albeit in a very different look, in a very different series. But it, at its core, it's the same car all the way through, which is quite stunning to have a car be at the top line of the sport. Okay, yeah, now it's starting to fall through the categories down the line a little bit, but quite an amazing run. It was sold to a collector in 2008. Who has had a long-term project to restore it to its VN Group A spec, predominantly how Wayne Gardner raced it at Bathurst in 92. So that means changing it from a Watts link to a Panhard bar rear end. But we've seen some recent conversions of cars from supercar era back to VN Group A in Jamie McDonald's product car, the VN Commodore, which had been a supercar later on, and the Nathan Pretty Young Bloke Cold Tires car had been restored to VN Group A, how Alf Barbagallo had raced it in the early 90s as well. So there are some runs on the board for people doing that. Big project, big cost, big time to retro convert those cars back beyond the spec line from Group A to Group 3A or whatever you want to call it, V8 supercars. So that's the good news, is that this car does survive. We do need to get a little bit of an update. The owner is a private collector whose identity we will not divulge, or his location we won't divulge either. But how good would that car – now, if you own this car, Will, what are you putting it back to? What would you see this car's most prestigious livery and specification of how you would like to see it?
For mine, it's probably the Crompton 93 GIO, VP, big wings.
Wayne Gardner headbutt car.
The Wayne Gardner headbutt car, yes. Yeah. For many different reasons. Like, it's a good-looking car, good-looking livery. I always had a soft spot for Crompton when I was growing up as a driver. So, yeah, all plays into it.
So, one of the things I also think about, too, with these things is, from a restoration point of view, it's kind of you're either all in or you're all out. You can't go halfway. You can't go – I don't feel you can put the – all right, I'm going to make it a VN, and I'm going to put the GIO livery on it. Yeah, but if the interior is not red, then it's not. You know, you got to go all the way. So I'm going Gardner 92. I think that's its most known situation. Because the other thing is with the Crompton GIO stuff, there is that other car that Neil ran later in 93. So there were two cars that you could make the GIO Commodore VP. So I guess it depends on if the person with the other car goes down that path with it, or they do something else with theirs.
You would imagine that would go back to a Coke car.
You'd think so, but you'd never know.
Well, maybe the differentiating bit would be to
let's
try
buy
and
them
find
both
a-
and then control it all.
Well, yeah, we could do that. Or we could get the early VP body kit, the aero kit, the one that didn't work.
Yeah,
and put that on this car.
Yeah, that didn't work for a reason because it wasn't that good.
Not being run in a competitive sense anymore.
No, that's true. Could be done. So that is an amazing life of a very interesting car, and it's helped us touch point on a bunch of different parts of Group A / V8 supercar racing history along the way. The GIO Commodore VNVP, the Strathfield car, the V8 racing car, the / / VNVP, VR, VS, V, everything. What a life. That is a pretty big race car life right there.
It's amazing. Like, the ups and downs that that car's had, the fact that so late in its Bathurst career, it had several high-profile moments that weren't associated with being... And at no point did this car go to Bathurst as an outright contender.
No. No,
at no point. No, and yet it still led a fascinating life.
And it became a new part of the solar system when a new planet was discovered.
Planet just beyond Pluto, isn't it?
Pluto's not a planet anymore, though, is it? Didn't they disqualify it as a planet over the years?
It's still Pluto. I don't think they call it a planet anymore.
I think it's like they rescinded its planet status somewhere along the line, I vaguely remember. But anyway, solar systems are not our expertise here on the VH Slim podcast, powered by Redcoat.
As evidenced by that little bit there.
As evidenced exactly by that little part there. Something else. Today is great news. As we drop this pod Wednesday, October the 20th, fantastic news we have to tell you about. The National Motor Racing Museum at Mount Panorama, she's back open for business, baby. Yes. Doors back open. Look forward to seeing as many people in there. Of course, there are restrictions. There are things you need to do to be able to gain entry to the museum. We'd ask that you respect those, and you respect that those are in place for a reason, because it allows them to open the doors. And if they don't open the doors, you can't see the cool stuff, and it doesn't work for anybody. So, great news with the museum being back open. Our great friends up there, Brad Owen and his team, do a ripping job. They've moved some stuff around. There's been some stuff go, some stuff arriving. There's some cool exhibitions coming up as well, so jump on there. For all the opening times, go to the museum's Bathurst website or the National Motor Racing Museum Facebook page to check out the days that they're open. Tuesdays, not open. Don't go on Tuesday. Doors don't open.
Look at the museum.
You can look at the outside, but that's about as good as you're going to get there as well. Another quick plug too to our great mates at the Motorsport Trader. They're keeping your motorsport memories alive. A bunch of cool memorabilia. There's panels. There's all sorts of cool stuff on their website. Jump on and have a look. You might just find yourself something for your man cave or your she shed for decorating the halls. It's leading up to Christmas. I'm getting into the festive spirit as well. So maybe it's a Christmas present or two that's a little bit different to what you would otherwise normally guess.
That is how the Christmas carol goes. What is it? Deck the halls with boughs of bonnets.
We've done it all. Solar system, Christmas carols. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this classic car episode of the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Of course, we're on the pathway to the Repco Bathurst 1000. We've got a bunch of Bathurst content in the lead up to the great race on the first weekend of December. Sounds very strange to say that, but we live in a strange world these times. So in December, we'll take it. We'll take any Bathurst we can get. Hey, thanks, Will. Really appreciate going down memory lane with you. We will see you on Planet Morph another time soon.
Yes.
Thanks again for listening, everybody. Please subscribe to the pod so you don't miss an ep. Leave us a review. Send us through your questions through socials and, of course, through the v8sleuth.com.au website. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because you'll get the latest and greatest from our site along the way. Thanks again for listening. We will chat to you again, same time, same channel, next week.